There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space, and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Dimensions, the Twilight Zone podcast. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 9, The Trouble with Templeton. This was written by E. Jack Newman and written for the teleplay was written by Rod Serling. It was directed by Buzz Kulick, produced by Buck Houghton, music by Marius Constant and Jeff Alexander. In the cast were Ben Ahern, Pippa Scott, Sidney Pollack, and Dave Wilcock. Its original air date was December 9th of 1960. And you can watch this on Tubi TV, Freevee TV, Paramount Plus, or the Blu-rays or DVDs. And again, I'll always say, if you have a little bit of extra spending cash, buy the Blu-rays. It's well worth it. Now, as I always say, fair warning ahead, there are spoilers. So if you haven't watched this episode, or if you haven't watched this episode in a while, pause this podcast that you're listening to and go watch the episode. Come back and finish the episode so I don't spoil anything for you, if you are so inclined. So, without any more pause, let's get to the opening narration. Pleased to present for your consideration, Mr. Booth Templeton, serious and successful star of over 30 Broadway plays, who is not quite all right today. Yesterday and his memories is what he wants, and yesterday is what he'll get. Soon his years and his troubles will descend upon him in an avalanche. In order to not be crushed, Mr. Booth Templeton will escape from his theater and his world, and make his debut on another stage, in another world, that we call the Twilight Zone. So, Mr. Booth Templeton, aging star of screen, or of stage, I should say. They don't really mention any screen credits. They say he was a star of over 30 Broadway plays, which, if anybody knows anything about Broadway and acting, that could span more than 30 years, most certainly. But even still, if not, the man has spent 30 years as a leading man in the theater, which is quite a feat, if you know anything about theater, which some of you may not. So Mr. Booth Templeton, star of over 30 Broadway plays. And they didn't say off-Broadway or what have you, summer stock. They said Broadway plays. So the man is very well known, very well respected, and obviously very well off. As you would be if you were a main draw on Broadway for 30 years. You know what I mean? You're going to make some money and people are going to know who you are, you know, in society, in the society, that goes to the theater, of course. So we see him getting ready to go to the theater to start rehearsal for his newest Broadway play that he'll be starring in, when he looks out of his window and talking to his butler or manservant. I don't know necessarily what he is. Maybe the chauffeur. You know, he might do a number of things. But he's known this man for many years. They talk as if they're old friends and not necessarily an employee-employer relationship. And Mr. Templeton looks out the window and see his wife getting friendly with a new pool boy acquaintance, member of the staff, who knows. But she is not necessarily being very discreet about it, so much so that Mr. Templeton even says she's not even bothering being discreet anymore, is she? So we know that Mrs. Templeton is not faithful to Mr. Templeton, which, with, you know, May-December romances, older men marrying younger women is not necessarily uncommon. And that's not a slap against women who marry older men or older men who marry younger women. That's just the way things are sometimes. People get into a situation for one good reason or another, and they wind up not being the situation that they necessarily want or that works for them. And instead of giving up that situation, they prolong it and they do whatever they please to make it bearable so that they can keep the status quo. And that can go either way for the man or the woman. In either situation, if the roles were reversed, it could go either way. But that's not the point of this story, is it? The point of the story is Mr. Booth Templeton, who longs for the days when he cared about anything that he did and about his life. Because we get the idea that at this point in his life, being an older man, he is basically just going through the motions to get through every day. And he even mentions that in his talking to his butler chauffeur that, you know, he'll go, he'll hopefully say his lines correctly. People will applaud. People will tell him he's done a great job. He will put on his coat, he will take off his makeup, put on his coat, get ushered to his car will take him home, and he will go to bed and lather, rinse, repeat. And so he is basically just going through the motions. He's basically on autopilot in his life at this time. And you get the sense that he's not very happy, and then he starts talking about that he hasn't had a whole lot of happiness in his life throughout his life. The one brief spot of happiness he had was for about 7 years when he was married to his first wife, Laura. He married her when she was 18 and she passed, although we don't know why, when she was 25. So he had a brief 7 years with her, and as an older man, he still thinks about it to that day, and it still haunts him to that day. And that was the only bright spot of happiness that he had in his life. So he goes to the theater, where he meets the man who is backing the play, because, you know, plays, just like movies, just like anything else, you have to have someone that has money to make the play happen, to buy the costumes, to rent the space, to hire the actors and the director, and to do all that requires quite a sum of money. So you need financial backers, which is who this is that Booth is talking to. So we learn that there's a new director, a younger man, instead of the man that was originally supposed to direct the play, who was subsequently fired the night before. And we learn that Booth is also 5 minutes late to rehearsal on the first day. Now, for someone that's been in 30 different plays on Broadway, you would think being 5 minutes late to rehearsal, no one would necessarily bat an eye if it was this fella. You know, if it was somebody that was relatively new, you might chastise them slightly or give them a minor going over. But not in this case. In this case, you might want to cut the old guy a little bit of slack. I mean, he's a professional nonetheless. Now, is 5 minutes late excusable? You know, it's 5 minutes late. You know, it's not like he shows up 2.5 hours after he's supposed to be there half drunk and acting like an idiot. He shows up ready to work. He's just a few minutes late. And that might not even have been anything of his fault. It might have been his traffic. You never really know. Booth doesn't necessarily seem like the type of fella that would be late for anything. So the fact that he was 5 minutes late, you know. But this new director sort of seems like a bit of a hard-nosed kind of fella who wants things done his way and his way only. And so he decides to publicly kind of scold Booth into, kind of scare him, maybe, you know, kind of scold him a little to make him, step two. And Booth doesn't like this. He gets asked by the director if he's, you know, ready to work or ready, you know, or not ready. And Booth kind of has a momentary, not a brain fart necessarily, but a moment of mania. And he runs out of the theater. When he gets outside, it is no longer mid-afternoon. It is now nighttime. And the pictures on the theater, the posters for the new plays on the theater outside, are no longer the new play that Booth is going to be starring in. It is now The Great Seed from 1927, which was apparently 1927's big hit in this part of the Twilight Zone, which Booth was also the star of. So automatically you kind of get the idea, okay, times have changed, he's now in the past. And he walks out the door from the rehearsal where he got scolded. He walks out and there's a crowd of people who are standing around at the stage entrance door clapping and cheering for him after having seen the play that he was just in, where he was again the star of. And he talks to one of the stagehands who tells him that his wife is waiting for him at a bar across the street, or just down the street, that she's, you know, told him that when he was done, have Booth come over to see her, because that's where she's at. And so, of course, he's very confused about this, as people that go back in time usually are. They're the, where am I, what year is it, that sort of thing. We play that game. He gets to the bar, which is actually a speakeasy, because, again, it's 1927. You know, we got this prohibition thing happening, and he gets let in, and the man says, oh, yeah, your wife's already inside. You know, what do you want to eat tonight? And Booth, of course, is very awestruck by everything that's going on. He doesn't still kind of understand that he's no longer in the present day. He's now in the past. He's still trying to wrap his mind around that. And then on top of that, he just got taken into a speakeasy, which doesn't exist in 1960, but surely existed in 1927. And he gets taken to where his wife is, who is sitting down eating steak and drinking a beer with the director of the play, who was also Booth's best friend, Mr. Barney Pflueger. Now, at this point, Booth is still very confused, but he's happy as can be to see his former or deceased or first wife, however you want to say it, most certainly the love of his life. He is excited and beyond the moon to see her, and all he wants to do is take her away and have some quiet time with her and talk to her and just spend time with her. And of course she doesn't want any of that. She wants to eat her steak, she wants to drink her beer, she wants to have a good time and dance. And Booth is not having it, and he even says at a point that, you know, I don't like what you've become. And at this point, the entire thing, you know, in his mind starts to unravel. He doesn't like the way his wife is acting. He can't make her change. He can't make her come with him. And she finally looks at him and says, why don't you go back where you came from? Because nobody wants you here. So he decides, after being heartbroken again, to get up and leave. And before he does that, he actually takes a script away from her where she was fanning herself because it was hot in the speakeasy and shoves it in his pocket. Sorry, I forgot about that. So after she tells him that no one wants him here and he should go back to his own time, he takes her advice and he walks out the door, and we get one of the best scenes in one of the, you know, in the Twilight Zone, in my opinion anyway, where you see the room, everybody kind of freezes as he's walking out, and you see the room get black. Like, the whole room goes black except a spotlight focused on Laura looking at him with just a sad sort of longing look on her face. And we then see Booth come out of the bar, back onto the street, which of course is like it just rained, like every night scene shot in a city in the Twilight Zone. Apparently it rains constantly in the city. But there's water all over the street. He runs back to the theater. It's still 1927. And he walks through the door, and it is again present day. And he sees the producer, or, you know, the money man, I guess you would say, of the play and the director standing there talking to each other and having coffee. And he reaches into his pocket because he can't believe he's now back in his time again, and starts fanning himself with the script that he got from Laura in 1927. He opens it up and he looks at it, and it's basically the entire scene that we just saw written out in play form, saying all the lines that Barney said, that Laura says, even up to and including, "Why don't you go back to your own time? Nobody wants you here." Where he realizes that, yes, he did go back in time, but that they were acting for his own good, and for him to go back to the present day and live his life while he still has it, and take charge of things instead of letting things take charge of him. So when he looks up, he sees the director and the money man standing there. And the director looks at him and says, "Well, what about it, Booth? Are you in or are you out?" Or he actually says, "Mr. Templeton." And Booth looks at him and says, "I am most definitely in. And it is most definitely Mr. Templeton to you." And then he looks at the money man and he says, "Oh, by the way, I don't want anyone not directly involved in the production of the play to be at any of the rehearsals, so you'll kindly leave." And the director, you know, of course, the money man's kind of taken aback by this, and the director says, "Oh, yeah, maybe you should get out of here." And so that guy leaves, and Booth says, "Now, are we ready?" And they go off to rehearse the new play. And with that, we get the closing narration. "Mr. Booth Templeton, who shared with most human beings the hunger to recapture the past moments, the ones that soften with the years. But in this case, the character of his past blocked him out and sent him back to his own time, which is where we find him now. Mr. Booth Templeton, who had a round-trip ticket into the Twilight Zone." So, the trouble with Templeton is, he tried to go back in time, or he longed to go back in time, and the Twilight Zone was gracious enough to give him a few minutes, a brief amount of nostalgia. And he learned that he didn't belong in the past, he belongs in the present. Now, this is one of those episodes that you can call it a companion piece to Walking Distance, in it that it's a very similar sort of episode, a very similar sort of idea about a man that wants to go back in time and relive his past life because of how great he thought it used to be. Or, you know, in Walking Distance, you know, he needed to slow down and take things in more and just get out of the rat race, so to speak. Whereas Mr. Templeton needed to be reinvigorated by life because he was too busy with his head in the past and needed to be woken up into the present. Now, this is a great episode, or at least in my opinion, let me rephrase. In my opinion, this is a great episode because, much like Walking Distance, which is also a great episode, in my opinion, it deals with something that a lot of people, especially when you get a few years under your belt, it deals with something that a lot of people have a hunger for, a need for, a want, and that is to go back in time when things were easier, simpler, better, happier, more fun, more entertaining, more enjoyable, more loving, more comfy. Any adjective you want to put there would pretty much work. But what people find is, and it mostly breaks their hearts, is that no matter what you do, you can't go home again. You can go back to where you came from. You can go back to the same house you grew up in. You can go back with the same people that you knew 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. But they're older, and the house is older, and the times are new. And just like oil and water, it doesn't mix. So while you really want to go back to that time doesn't exist. And so you're left with faded memories and today's news. And it just doesn't mix. So Mr. Templeton wanted to go back in time and wanted to see his deceased wife again and be that husband that he used to be to that woman that he had such a fond affection for and a great love. And he found that he couldn't do it again. Not because of himself, but because of everything else. And so he was given the chance to come back and live in the future, or live in the present, and leave the past in the past. And it's a great lesson, and it's a great episode, and it's a very touching episode, and the thing that seals it, the thing that makes the episode great, it was a good episode, but what makes the episode great is the scene in the speakeasy, where she tells him to go back to his present, to his time where he came from, because nobody wants him here. And he leaves. And the entire place freezes and then starts to slowly fade out until we just see her face in some of the best acting facial feature-wise that I've seen. And she just, you can see her heart is breaking as much as his was to send him back without having to give, or without being able to give him the love that she so wanted to give him. But she had to play a part too, and her part was to make sure that he got back to the present day, maybe a little wiser and maybe a little better, even having been heartbroken again. And it's a great scene in a great episode that I think a lot of viewers and a lot of people that like the show, even casually, I think this one gets missed by a lot of people, and that makes me sad because it's a great episode. And it's a very nostalgic episode. Is it as good as Walking Distance? No, in my opinion, Walking Distance is better. But this one is not to be missed as well. Much like Walking Distance, not to be missed. So, with that, why don't we get on to the bios? So, Booth Templeton was played by Brian Ahern, who was born in 1902 and passed away in 1983, and he had a total of 70 acting credits to his IMDb, going all the way back to 1924's The 11th Commandment, starring in movies throughout the 20s into the 30s, where he was in movies such like What Every Woman Knows, I Live My Life, The Great Garrick, Vigil in the Night, The Man Who Lost Himself, and then in the 40s, My Sister Eileen, A Night to Remember from 1942, and then once television started to get going, he started appearing in episodic shows such as the Ford Theater Hour, the Pulitzer Prize Playhouse, Lux Video Theater, Robert Montgomery Presents, the Eddie Cantor Comedy Theater, Producer Showcase, stop me if you've heard these, Climax, Cavalcade of America, Studio 57, the Goodyear Theater, and of course, one episode of The Twilight Zone. But he was also in Wagon Train, Rawhide, Magical World of Disney, in the movie 1964's The Cavern, and then his last on-screen appearance was in the 1967 movie Rosie. He got his first big stage recognition at the age of 18 when he made his debut as an adult with the company that would eventually turn into the Birmingham Repertory Theatre in England, where he was born. When he was 21, he made his debut on London's West End and decided to study architecture instead of continuing acting, but the acting bug was too strong, and he returned to theater in 1923, and for the next 8 years, he toured and appeared in the West End productions, various West End productions. In 1931, he made his Broadway debut, playing Robert Browning in The Barretts of Wimpole Street. He alternated between New York and the London stage. Then, in the early 30s, he got into movies, which led him to be a character actor in several movies through the 30s. In 1940, he was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for the movie Juarez, playing the Emperor Maximilian. He published his autobiography in 1969, and 10 years later, he published a biography of his best friend, George Sanders, entitled A Dreadful Man. Unfortunately, he passed away in 1986 at the age of 83. So moving on, the woman who played Laura, his first wife, who was deceased, was played by Pippa Scott, who was born in 1935 and is still alive today. She has 88 acting credits on IMDb, starting out in 1953 in an episode of Your Playtime. Then, in the 1956 movie The Searchers, starring, of course, John Wayne and Vera Miles. As a bit player in a lot of movies, which led her to get into television, being in such things as the General Electric Theater, Maverick, The DuPont Show with June Allison, The Alaskans, of course, one episode of The Twilight Zone, Thriller, Have Gun Will Travel, The Outlaws, stop me if you've heard this, Dr. Kildare, Follow the Sun, The United States Steel Hour, The Fugitive, Wagon Train, Gomer Pyle, USMC, alternating basically between movies and television. She was also in My Six Loves, The Confession, For Pete's Sake, and Dundee and the Kuhane. She was also in F Troop, Tarzan, I Spy, Judge for the Defense. I mean, you name it, she's been pretty much in it. Appearing in TV and movies throughout the 60s and the 70s. With her last on-screen appearance being in the movie Footprints in 2009. She was educated at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London, and she debuted in Child of Fortune in 1956, based upon Henry James' Wings of the Dove. That same year, she had a featured role as Lucy in John Ford's classic western, The Searchers. The following year, she returned to Broadway with a brief run of Miss Lonely Hearts and added a couple of films to her resume when she co-starred as a novice school teacher who was harassed in the low-budget, highly obscure drama As Young as We Are in 1958, and played a part in the iconic comedy hit Auntie Mamie, starring Rosalind Russell, in 1958. The TV mostly kept her going throughout the 50s and the 60s, where she also sporadically took on stage time in between doing TV shows or the few movies that she did during that time. She, along with her then-husband, producer Lee Rich, was a founding partner of Lorimar Productions, which is a well-known television production company, or was a well-known television production company, Emmy Award-winning at that, which is the single largest provider of programming to the networks for 2.5 decades. They produced such classics as The Waltons, Dallas, Falcon Crest, Knott's Landing, Eight is Enough, and also produced the Oscar and Emmy-winning films Moonstruck, A Fish Called Wanda, Sybil, and Being There. In the 80s, she focused her attention to humanitarian issues, founding the International Monitor Institute, or IMI, which is a non-profit organization dealing with the prosecution of war crimes. IMI concentrated on the Balkans, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, the Congo, Cambodia, Iraq, and child soldiers. The IMI is still around today and is residing in the Human Rights Department at Duke University. Ms. Scott also began Linden Productions to develop and produce documentaries related to international conflict and human rights violations. Linden has made numerous films for organizations such as the UN, the Human Rights Watch, and the International Rescue Committee, to name a few. So, a very interesting woman who had quite a career, not only on screen, but off screen as well. Now, I may have glossed over Buzz Kulick, but that is to say I didn't. because he is a somewhat of a fixture in the Twilight Zone, directing 9 episodes in total of the Twilight Zone. So if you want to hear about his biography, go back to Season 2, Episode 1, King 9 Will Not Return, where I talked about him then. But he does several good episodes. He directed Static. He directed 100 Yards Over the Rim. He directed, of course, this episode. He directed A Game of Pool. He also directed 2 episodes in Season 4, which are very good. Jess Bell and On Thursday, We Leave for Home. So if you want to know anything about Buzz Kulik, go back and listen to King 9 Will Not Return. And lastly but not leastly, the man who played the director of the play was played by none other than Sidney Pollack. Now, you've heard this name before. Sidney Pollack was born in 1934, passed away at the age of 73 in 2008. Now, who was Sidney Pollack? Well, that's a good question. He has 312 credits on his IMDb, so he has a monster IMDb page, but we'll just go over what, we'll just hit the high points with him. He was an Academy Award-winning director, producer, actor, and writer, and public figure who directed and produced well over 40 films, including Tootsie with Dustin Hoffman, Out of Africa with Meryl Streep and Robert Redford, The Firm with Tom Cruise, one of my favorite Paul Newman movies, Absence of Malice in 1981, 3 Days of the Condor, Jeremiah Johnson, and just hundreds and hundreds of episodes of television shows. So if you've seen that man before, well, now you know who he is. He was a well-known director, and he played a director on The Twilight Zone. So that'll do it for the bios. Let's go to the trivia for the episode. So at the beginning, while Templeton is watching his wife, openly be with her boyfriend, it is the same pool that is used in the episode The Bewitching Pool in the 5th season. Also in the Queen of the Nile episode as well in 1964, the 5th season also. And trivia, this episode takes place in 1927 and 1960. So not a lot of trivia for this episode, but that's not going to stop us from moving forward. So let's go on to the goofs of the episode, and there's really not much of them either. When Booth grabs Laura to stop her from dancing when they're in the speakeasy, her flapper beads end up hanging from her neck in 2 long strands because he breaks them. Later they are shown intact. When Booth first appears in 1927, the Great Seed movie poster facing the street has the sign play poster, not movie poster, has the sign 1927's Big Hit slanted down to the right, covering up the name Booth. The different poster behind it has 1927's Big Hit horizontal and Acclaim It, and instead of Booth's name. When Booth runs back to the theater from the speakeasy, the posters are swapped, and when Booth examines the posters up close, they're switched back. The papers in Laura's hands change position while she is fanning air with them. Laura first grabs the papers as the camera shows 3 characters, Booth, Laura, and Barney, at the table, and the dark stripes on the papers are facing the camera. The next angle only shows Booth and Laura, and she is still fanning air, but the papers are in her hands differently, with the dark stripes now facing the new camera position. And when he goes back to 1927, and he's in the speakeasy with his now-deceased wife, Laura, She has thick eyebrows, giving away that an actress from 1960 would have, and not eyebrows that an actress in 1927 era would have had. In the 20s, women mostly had the fashion of the time for women was to have the shaved, painted on eyebrows and not the, you know, really thick ones like Miss Scott or even if you look at like Elizabeth Taylor from back in the 50s and 60s, her eyebrows, not the same. So, but I'll be honest with you, I was too focused on the actual episode to worry about whether Miss Scott's eyebrows were thick or thin or drawn on or shaved, and I didn't notice, to be honest with you. And that does it for the goofs of the episode. So let's move on to the likes and dislikes. The likes of this episode, I like the whole episode, to be honest with you. I loved Brian Ahern's performance as well as Pippa Scott's. Even Sidney Pollack's. Everybody was great in this episode. And it was directed well. It was written well. And everyone did really great. It was a very heartwarming, very touching episode. Very nostalgia-based, nostalgia-driven, much like, as we mentioned before, Walking Distance. If you haven't watched that one or listened to that one, go back and listen to that episode of the podcast and watch that episode of The Twilight Zone, because it is one of the finer points in the series, in my opinion. Much like this one is. This one is a sleeper. A lot of people, it seems like it's one of those episodes that sort of gets pushed away to the wayside for more flashy and more well-known episodes like Eye of the Beholder or Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, etc., etc. And for that being, even though there are many, many more better episodes than this one, this is still a great episode. Now, is it in my top 10, top 15, top 20, top 25? Probably not. Top 50? Yes. It's a very great show, very great episode, very nostalgic episode, and it's just a great episode all the way around. It's a very good episode, and I like it a lot. I really can't say anything I don't like about it, other than, you know, it's one of those you almost wish it was longer to kind of be fleshed out a little better. You almost wish it was an hour-long episode, but sadly it wasn't, but the tightness, I think, also keeps it moving and keeps it from having slow spots or spots where it might just prattle about and sort of get lost in the sauce. So that brings us to casting for this episode. Now, if Hollywood were to call me and say, Bill, we're going to remake this episode and we want you to, who would you cast for this episode? And I would say, well, for Mr. Booth Templeton, I would cast Mr. Michael Keaton, because I think he can do it fantastically. He's actually a fantastic actor. You know, I know younger people, and I don't know of anybody that might be 20 years old that's listening to this thing, but younger people may only know him as Batman in the Flash or, you know, the original Batman from 1989 if they went back and nostalgia watched something, you know, that their parents looked at or what have you. But if you look back over his career, he is actually a very great actor. And I think he's been underutilized in a lot of things for a lot of years. And I'm happy to see him finally getting back into things that are going more mainstream and getting him recognition. Just a great actor. And I think he would do good in this instance. For Laura, his wife, I would like to see Keira Knightley do it, because she, while being a great actress, is also very stunning. She's extremely pretty, but she also has a very expressive face, which you kind of need in this role, especially for that one scene in the speakeasy. You have to have a face that is very expressive, and she does have one of those faces. And I think she'd kill it. And lastly, for the director of the play, throw Tobey Maguire in there. I think it's a small part, but I think he'd do well at it. So, with that being said, let's move on to, lastly but not leastly, the moral or philosophy of this episode. Well, I think we've covered a little bit of that, and certainly you can go back and watch Walking Distance and sort of take away the same messages from there as well. Obviously, you can't go home again. Stop living in the past. Focus on the present and on the future. I mean, what else is there to say? The past is the past for a reason, just like X's are X's for a reason. You know, you can't go back and revisit it because it's never the same. And you'll realize why you shouldn't be there in the first place. And I think it's a great message for today. I thought it was a great message, you know, 64 years ago. And I think it'll be a great message 64 years from now. You can't go home again, folks, as much as you want to. You can't go home again. It just doesn't work that way. We're here when we're here, and we're gone when we're gone. That's the best and worst part about life, is that you can't stop it, and you can't go back, and you can't relive. And maybe you'd find that if you could, it didn't taste as sweet as it used to. And maybe that's the idea. But I don't think that any of us have to worry about that. The only thing we have to worry about now is, if you want to drop me a line, leave me some feedback, tell me I stink, tell me I'm great, whatever you want to tell me, please drop me a line at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. Tell all your friends, neighbors, relatives, write it on the bulletin board at school about my podcast. I'd love for more than 15 people to listen to me at one point in time. And for the 15 that actually do listen to me, thank you so much for allowing me to prattle on for an hour a week about a 64-year-old television show. That's near and dear to my heart, and I appreciate each and every one of you. So, thank you, and stay tuned for next week's episode, when we have one of the fun girls from the Andy Griffith show up and star in an episode about a camera that can see the future. So, stay tuned for that, folks, and thank you as always for listening, and good night.